Ways and Means for Wednesday, May 4th, 2005, and open a public hearing on SB 5513, the Department of Higher Education, SB... Did I say 13?
You said 13.
5514, the Department of Higher Education Capital Construction. Mr. Chancellor.
Chair Devlin, members of the subcommittee, for the record, George Pernsteiner, Acting Chancellor, Oregon University System. Thank you for having us back here this morning. We are going to lead off this morning with one of our board members and one of our presidents, Don Blair, who is the chair of our Finance, Budget, Personnel, and Audit and Real Estate Committee, which is a true mouthful, and is also CFO of the Nike Corporation, and Ed Ray, the president of Oregon State University.
Blair and President Ray, please proceed whenever you would.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Well, Chair Devlin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Don Blair. I am Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Nike, Inc., and I'm here today speaking to you as a member of the State Board of Higher Education and the Chair of the Board's Committee on Finance and Administration. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak about the very important work that the State Board is doing with financial management and accountability, with particular emphasis on managing fund balances. The role of the Board in providing oversight and financial accountability is something that we all take very seriously. And over the past year, we've implemented a number of measures that we think will help us ensure financial accountability across the Oregon University system, including establishment of several new financial policies and regular review of actual and projected financial results for each OUS institution. The State Board of Higher Education believes that responsible fiscal management requires adequate reserves or fund balances to reduce current and future risks. Adequate fund balances are essential to offset unforeseen fluctuations in revenues and expenses. And the way I think about this is that we have to hold reserves based upon really two factors. One is the level of volatility that's in our operations, and secondly, the number of levers that we have to pull in order to manage that volatility. Some of the circumstances that can create volatility in our financial results are catastrophic events such as a natural disaster, unforeseen declines in revenue, say from a loss of grants or enrollment declines, unexpected legal obligations such as the recent changes in PERS and the medical benefits provided under the PEB, higher than budgeted charges for state agency services, failure of a major system in the campus physical plant or infrastructure, or critical health, safety, or code issues in our facilities and infrastructure. As you know, private sector companies also face uncertainty in the amount of revenues that they receive or the expenses that they might incur. However, if you think about the Oregon University system, we don't have all of the same tools to manage that volatility as a private company would have. The price of our product, which is generally tuition, really can't be changed midterm, and many of our costs are fixed, especially in the short term. And unlike many other state agencies, a large portion of the Oregon University system budget is devoted to providing contractually required services to students and grantors. In addition, while a private company can operate at a loss, at least for a short period of time, the Oregon University system can't run a deficit. So adequate fund balances ensure that each campus can provide a stable set of programs and services for students and also to meet the obligations that we have to grantors. But I wanted to reassure you that the board recognizes that these fund balances should be adequate to protect the system, but not excessive. That's our obligation to both the citizens of Oregon as well as to the students who pay tuition to the system. So in July of 2004, after extensive discussion and review, the State Board of Higher Education adopted a policy on ending fund balances for each of the OUS institutions. Our policy established a target for ending fund balances at 10% of their operating revenues. And this target was based on an assessment of the level of financial risk that the campuses could prudently manage and is consistent with the recommendations of the Government Finance Officers Association, which targets a reserve of 5 to 15% of operating revenues. And now each quarter, the board monitors campus fund balance projections and requires an explanation for any significant fluctuation or variances against the 10% target. If an institution's fund balance is projected to fall below 5% or rise above 15% of operating revenues by the end of a fiscal year, the university president is required to report to the board on plans to bring the fund balance in line with the policy target. Now, the board takes this responsibility very seriously, and we have taken decisive action when that was required. For example, last summer, Western Oregon University projected that its fund balance would be well above the 10% target as of the end of fiscal 2004. So in response, the board froze tuition at Western Oregon University for the 2004-2005 school year and directed instead that the campus use a portion of the fund balance to pay for those tuition increases, or to pay expenses and prevent tuition increases. The board also used a portion of the chancellor's office fund balance last year to mitigate tuition increases for this current school year. Now, the board has also taken steps to ensure that the OUS financial reporting, projections, and analysis is timely, accurate, and available to the public and state policymakers. It's important to us that legislators have clear, concise information to support the difficult decisions that you all must make. So to give you a perspective on fund balances from the point of view of an individual institution, now I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Edward Ray, President of Oregon State University.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you. What I'd like to do is speak to some of the specific situations that we find on OUS campuses to give you an idea of how fund balances are used, and obviously I'll make particular reference to conditions at Oregon State University. As Director Blair has already pointed out, unlike many state agencies, university budgets are quite volatile. There's no mystery behind that. Two-thirds of our funding comes from tuition and other sources of revenue, and obviously we have variable costs associated with such activities as housing and dining and many of the other affiliated activities that go on at the university. The interesting thing about tuition is that we don't know what our tuition revenues are going to be until October, after the students have enrolled and classes have begun, and that's 4 months into the fiscal year. We have to make decisions up front about faculty hiring, about course offerings, about what we think the demands on residence and dining halls will be, and many of our other services. So, and many of those are determined by contract. So our cost structure is generally pretty well defined by the beginning of the academic year, even though our revenue figures are not known with certainty. An interesting historical fact that I've learned in the process of talking about our current fund balance situation is that apparently the chancellor's office was able to maintain a reserve on behalf of all of the universities to help backstop against catastrophic or unanticipated funding problems, and that fund stood at $20 million in 1999. I understand that fund now stands at $4 million and is declining rapidly. And the simple reality is, with the changes in trying to promote efficiency and cost effectiveness taken by the board, that the grants and contracts and other sources of revenue for that chancellor's reserve fund simply aren't there anymore. And so when the fund runs out, the universities will be depending upon their own resources to remain in balance. There are three universities that are below the 10% target figure that Director Blair mentioned: Southern Oregon University, the Oregon Institute of Technology, Western Oregon University. You may remember there were issues about Western Oregon University's fund balances that got a lot of attention last summer. They're now below 10%. They knew that was going to happen. Sometimes these things are hard to explain. When you take a snapshot at a moment in time, you can get yourself pretty excited about fund balances, but you need to know what the commitments against those fund balances are. Let me give you a couple of examples from Oregon State University. I began a dialogue with our students really, I guess, a year ago this spring about tuition plateau charges and I hope you know what those are. But when all of you went to those, all of you went to college, I went to college, we went to places where usually if you took credit hours, that was a full-time equivalent. Most people took 15, 17, 18, whatever number of credit hours, and it all cost the same. Once you paid full tuition, that was it. One of the decisions that was made in this state before I got here in 2002, 2003, was to start smoothing charges for credit hours, in effect moving toward a per credit hour charge, so that a student taking 15 credit hours would pay more than a student taking 12, for example. We had a discussion on our campus last spring. I decided not to make an increase in plateau charges for this past academic year. I met with student, staff, and faculty again this year. We talked about the plateau. The arguments I got is a student has to take 15 credit hours a quarter for 4 years to graduate in 4 years. Why would you charge him more to take 15 credit hours than to take 12? And what I decided is we're eliminating the plateau credit charges. So starting next autumn, students at Oregon State University will pay the same tuition whether they take 12 credit hours or 16 credit hours. That's going to cost the university $2 million a year in revenue. What we anticipate, regardless of what else happens to our budget, is that we will use $4 million in our fund balances over the next two academic years while we work on strategies to figure out how we're permanently going to take that $2 million per year out of other activities to make sure we're in long-term balance. But what the fund balance allows us to do is have time to planfully make the changes in operations that we need to make to go forward and maintain balance. Another example I would give you is we adopted a strategic plan last year and talked about we're going to be focused and there are areas we're going to work on. We sent out a call for proposals for departments and colleges to collaborate for new areas of focus and investment in the university. We collected the money from ourselves, so we're talking about redirecting existing budget dollars into new program initiatives to move the university forward. To do that, we had to draw back $2 million from the colleges and support units. That $2 million over the course of the next year or so will go into six initiatives that we've identified on a competitive basis to put that money in. But the $2 million right now is sitting in the fund balance because we've just made that decision. So that tells you from those two examples alone, $6 million of our fund balance is going out the door in the next 2 years, and it's going to help us make transitions to the future that we think are important and worth making. Another observation that I would make, and Director Blair talked about the financial standards for what fund balances ought to look like, 5 to 15, a target of 10. Unlike even many of the private businesses that you're all aware of, we don't have lines of credit. If we have a cash flow problem, there's nobody to go to. In a sense, our go-to person used to be the Chancellor's office where they had the $20 million reserve. That's disappearing. So we have to have a certain amount of flexibility in our fund balance because we're the only place we can turn to deal with unanticipated problems. And to give you a sense of some unanticipated, some not so unanticipated problems. My understanding is the PERS projects that in July of 2007 we're going to be looking at, this is at Oregon State University, another $14 million in costs for PERS. About $6 million of that is going to come out of, if the system stays the way it is, out of state support. But $8 million is going to have to come out of OSU's budget. Whatever that budget is, $8 million is going to have to come out of that. I'm certain that we'll be able to use fund balances for a period of a year or so to help us do thoughtful, sensible changes in our operations to accommodate what will become a permanent long-term cost. There are other examples I could give. I mentioned that Southern Oregon University is below the 10% figure. They spent a lot of their fund balances this last year doing some renovation work on a building where there was an asbestos problem that nobody knew was there before. They spent $500,000 of their fund balance on that. Even at Oregon State University, and I know that you all are considering the capital budget and we very much appreciate the understanding that we're getting about the plight of our power plant and the need to make a change. But I can tell you, just this past winter, for duct tape and a few other things to kind of keep it going, and thanks to the good weather, that's all we needed. We spent $300,000 out of our fund balance to keep the power plant operating in the winter because we were having difficulties with it. I'll stop there, and I know that Director Blair and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Blair, I wonder, have you analyzed why Oregon University System's costs have increased so much more rapidly than consumer price indexes? And have you identified those cost drivers?
I do believe that you have something on the agenda coming up in the next day or so to talk about our cost analysis. But your question, I can't answer it in detail yet, but one of the things that this board has been very focused on is digging into the cost drivers and really understanding what it is that our expense structure is related to from a delivery of output to students. And so my sense is that the Oregon University System has been responsible with expenses. I won't tell you that any large organization, whether it be Nike or the Oregon University System, doesn't have opportunities. But we are very committed to analyzing those costs and expenses, and I don't believe that the Oregon University System has been woefully inefficient. So I cannot answer your specific question about expense growth related to the CPI, but I can tell you that we are in the process of analyzing the OUS cost structure.
Thank you.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ray, you mentioned the tuition plateau issue and paying. If you're a student, you're going to pay the same amount for tuition for 12 credits versus 16, which brings up the question of what percentage of your students are graduating in 4 years versus five or more? Because if they're graduating in 4 years, that sort of model sort of makes sense. But if people are really taking 5 years, you're charging the folks that are maybe taking 12 and have to work on the side are probably carrying the load for those people that are paying 16. I mean, they're paying the same price and getting less. So.
Well, actually, our six-year graduation rate is about 61.2%. I think our four-year graduation rate, and the Chancellor's Office would have better figures on this, I would bet it's about 20-22%. I think that's not unrepresentative of universities across the country, that students are taking longer. It's really, it would be helpful, I think, for me to explain that in making this decision about creating that plateau range, we didn't raise tuition for students paying 12 credit hours. We eliminated the charge. That's why we're going to have to eat $2 million a year in costs that we can't cover through tuition revenue anymore because we've eliminated that charge. So we haven't shifted the cost from students who will now take 15 credit hours with no added expense if they go from 12 to 15. We think part of the reason why the percentages are low for 4 years is because of this business of ratcheting up the costs associated with trying to get to 15 so you can graduate in 4 years. We're not dumping those costs back on students. In terms of our population, and that's why I would never argue that, you know, every institution should do what Oregon State University is doing, but my understanding looking at our credit hours is that close to 80% of our students are taking 15 credit hours. So we're still looking very much like a traditional university where most of our students are, in fact, trying to take, you know, on the order of 15 or more credit hours. If you take a university, and my colleague presidents could talk about this more specifically, but I think, for example, if you look at Portland State University, and I think this was true at Southern and OIT, they may have have as many as 60 or 80% of their students who are part-time taking much fewer than 15 credit hours. And there the equity argument is pretty strong that the majority of students, vast majority, would be subsidizing a small minority of the students who could afford to take the higher credit load. So part of it has to do with our structure.
To follow up, what is the tuition for someone taking 16, and what is the tuition for someone taking 12?
Well, right now, if you were to look at 16 versus 12, we add $25 per credit hour for everything above 12.
Okay.
So basically, 13, 14, 15, 16, it's $100 per quarter more. That's what we're eliminating.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Just a quick question on this, and maybe the Chancellor's office would be more knowledgeable than perhaps you would on that. But do you have any history as far as, or any knowledge as far as this plateauing, to plateau or not to plateau issue in other universities around the nation?
Well, I'll tell you
what's
that
the norm.
Yeah, if you ask me what the norm is, not to have plateau charges. Not to have plateau charges at all is the norm around the country. I know that the other institutions here in Oregon that have gone to plateau charges have carefully monitored what happened before they had the charges, what happened after the charges, and I believe they can argue pretty forcefully that their experience has been that they're not, some I think, there may be some who would argue that it has had an effect, but at least in the testimony to our own board last spring that I heard, most of the presidents were willing to argue that it was not having a dramatic effect. We felt at Oregon State University that it was having an effect, not so much in terms of number of credit hours taken, but that students, part of what you want students to do is get a breadth of exposure to different ideas and experiences. That's part of what college is about. And that students were systematically making decisions not to join service organizations, not to get involved in school activities that would give them one credit hour that they used to, even if this sounds crazy, because they didn't want to have to come up with another $25 to give service to other people. So part of it was, you know, maybe more psychological or social than economic, but people were starting to pull back and saying, if I got to pay for everything, I'm only going to take what I have to take to graduate, and I'm getting out of here. Now, part of the reason why I don't think you'll see a big shift in a short period of time in credit hours before the plateau charges are put in place and after is students are smart. I mean, they figure out it's going to cost me more next year than it costs this year. So if I got to decide, am I going to take one more credit hour this year or defer it to next year when I think it's going to cost more to go to college, I'm going to try to get it done while I can get it done. So there are a lot of forces working on students' decisions about do I take more credit hours, fewer credit hours. We felt it was hurting the broad educational experience our students were getting to have those charges. They were pulling back and focusing only on what they had to absolutely take to graduate. And that's not what we want. We want them to try different things.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
My reason for the question is a concern I have about losing some of Oregon's brightest and best with this what I call new system of charging of tuition. Anecdotal sort of evidence, I understand, but I am aware of, I agree with you, students are smart. And I'm aware of a group of students who went out of state because they sat down and did the arithmetic, and they happened to be very good students. They got out of state waivers, I mean, you know, et cetera, sort of thing. But they sat down and did the arithmetic, and it was counterproductive for them to stay in state. Productive, maybe the wrong word. It was counterproductive to their banking accounts for them to stay in state. They could go out of state cheaper than they could stay in state.
Well, we felt confident, and this is only in our own bailiwick, that at Oregon State University we needed to go back to no plateau charges.
Most of those students would probably have been headed for one of the two or three major universities.
Any additional questions? President Ray and Mr. Blair, I've heard some of the same anecdotal evidence that Representative Jensen has heard, and heard some concerns, particularly from student groups, that students are choosing, you know, in a time of high tuition and low aid, it's one thing to make your financial plans so that you can graduate maybe in 5 years instead of six. But it's another thing if all you can do is manage to stay on, and the difference between attending 12 hours or 16 is the difference between how much money you have or don't have. I would hope that we'd find some way in this next interim period or this next 2 years of experience to monitor this fairly carefully to see what the impact is and to see if we see any movement in terms of the percentages for graduation. I don't think the decision was made lightly to change the system, but I think at the same time we have some responsibility to monitor what's happening with it. One question I had about the ending fund balances is I'm just trying to think about this in general terms. When the board talks between 5 and 15% of the annual operating, Mr. Bender has identified the operating cost for the university system is about $3 billion a biennium or $1.5 billion a year. So that would lead me to believe that operating balances could be in probably in the neighborhood of $150 million. Would that be somewhere in the for the total of the system?
Well, first of all, I do believe in your package of materials that you do have a schedule of projected fund balances for OUS somewhere in your documentation. My sense would be, and there's folks from the Chancellor's office that'll be more accurate on this than I, but that figure is probably including all of the various funds of the university system. What we're discussing really here is mostly the education and general fund balance, which is a smaller number than that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're talking about a figure, I think it's...
About $95
million. Yeah. $95 million.
Right, in annual fund balance, currently projected.
I don't consider that particularly excessive in a system of your size. Any additional questions at this point?
Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, folks, for coming and discussing. I have just a couple questions on the governor's recommended budget, the original one, budget about $750 million. I see that between the House and the Senate, we're raising that up somewhere around $50 million. But if you look down into the details of it, I think that there's a line item called Reduced Education and General Programs of about $14.8 million that they both reduce. Could you explain to me what effect, what are those programs? Do you have some idea where I'm at and what I'm talking about? I'm not really talking off your thing, but just off the governor's recommended budget. Maybe...
Okay, we may need to get a little bit of help here on that question.
Maybe the guy next to you might be able to help you out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that for $14.8 million, actually it's part of a presentation we were going to give later today or tomorrow, more on the 090 reductions the governor made. They are reductions to all of the resource allocation model line items with the exception of the small schools funding, the Cascade campuses, and the nanotechnology support you approved last biennium. So they would be reductions to the Chancellor's office in the cell value for funding, for enrollment-based funding, for the research support for public services. We can give you a list. I don't have that with me right now as to what each of those reductions are in each of those lists, but I think that the presentation here later today when we talk about the impact, we'll be talking about some of the overall impact of the governor's budget in this area. So.
Thank you.
What I can tell you at the risk of getting myself in trouble is that if I understand it, the essential budget level figure was 581.5 the governor's is $36 million less than that. The changes from the governor's recommended budget is another $5.8 million cut. So business as usual is not sustainable. I can tell you from our internal discussions within the university, we know we're looking at 4% or greater cuts in unit budgets to move money around to be able to manage our affairs going forward based on the kind of figures we have available, these kinds of figures at this point. The numbers will change, obviously, but we're talking cuts. We're not talking business as usual.
Yeah, I mean, just follow up there. That's based upon the governor's recommended budget or the...
That's both changes. That's the governor's recommended budget cut the request by $36 million from the central budget level. And then this, I'm working with the same numbers
you co-chairs. Were
President Ray, and then
yeah.
the co-chair's changes were an additional $5.8 million cut based upon the numbers I had.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Nelson, I'll have a presentation later today or tomorrow. We will be making the point the essential budget level, we believe, is overstated significantly. And so the cuts that we think we need you to address really are the $14.8 million.
Mr. McGee, you don't have your name on the record, although I...
excuse me, Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Chair, that's because Mr. McGee rarely gets to say anything.
It's only when presidents speak out of turn it needs to intercede.
Mr. Chair, I did have a comment.
Yes.
Nice to see you, Dr. Ray. You're looking very well. I was listening as I was preparing, and I heard the question about the tuition plateau, and I just wanted to comment that we had a Senate Bill 747 was in my education committee on the tuition plateau, and we had gotten stuffed the bill with something else, but not until the students were allowed to come in and give us a presentation on that. And there are valid concerns about that, and I told the students that I wasn't willing to go forward on changing that this session because it had just been implemented and I want to see how that works, but that I pledged to be very dedicated in addressing that next session if I felt that it has had an impact on students. I did not know that OSU had not made that change, and so I appreciated hearing that, and Jock was in my office telling me about that a couple of days ago. So I just want to tell you I appreciated that, and it gave me a perspective on what the actual tuition increase was for students at OSU compared to other places. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm concerned about it. I hope to stay as chair of the education committee in the interim, and I'm going to stick with this because the students have a real valid concern. So thank you. That's just more of an editorialization than a question. I could turn it into, is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Just, from your viewpoint, we're having some difference of opinion between the governor's budget on the student assistant commission, the budgeting, and both the House and the Senate. What I'm understanding from the students, they like the governor's budget better because it gives more access to more people, also includes some community college. Do you have any comment on where you guys look at that, how you view that?
I'm sorry, just to clarify the question, you mean the difference between tuition versus Oregon Opportunity Grant? Is that what you're
talking about? I guess we're looking at the Oregon Opportunity Grants and freezing tuition and that type, and the 2+2, and things I'm trying to get my arms around, so I'm just trying to get some information from you guys.
I'm willing to,
I'll
and then you can straighten it out. I'll give you my 1 minute take on all this. Frankly, money that goes to Oregon Opportunity Grant provides the possibility of capable students who, through no fault of their own, lack the economic means to get an education. It gives them the chance to get an education. It also has the effect that as the students go to a university, they bring those Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars with them. So to the extent that it represents new enrollment to the institutions, it brings resources that makes it easier for those institutions to provide the courses and instruction and so forth that the student needs. To the extent that you put money in enrollment growth, it does the same thing. I understand we haven't had enrollment growth money since, I'll get in more trouble here, 99 or something. Well, enrollment has grown. I mean, I'm not getting a lot of sensible signals out of Salem about what you want us to do in higher education. I understand that you want us to educate more people, but you don't want to pay for enrollment growth. I don't understand that. I mean, it doesn't add up. I mean, at some level I understand it, but it doesn't add up. So from my perspective, dollars for enrollment growth and dollars for OOG create possibilities to educate more students and bring the dollars necessary to provide that education. Tuition freeze dollars substitute state precious E&G dollars for tuition dollars. They don't change the revenues available to the institutions because the numbers you're working with are calculated on present enrollment. If we get new students, we don't have any new dollars to educate them with. Would I like to see enrollment tuition rates go up slower? Yeah. That's why I eliminated the plateau charges. So for next year, for example, if a student comes to Oregon State University and everybody does a 7% tuition increase, a student who takes 15 credit hours at Oregon State University will pay 1.5% more next year than they're paying this year, because at the same time the tuition is going up, we're eliminating those $25 per credit hour charges between 12 and 16 credit hours. So we get it that we're trying to do what we can to work on the issues of access and affordability, but the most important things you could do, I think, and this is me talking, for OSU, for the system, to help with access and affordability is dollars to enrollment growth and OOG.
Yeah, and my point of view would actually be the same. I believe, first of all, that we have to be thinking about what is money for the enterprise. I think what we have is a system that's been disinvested, and I'm very concerned about the quality of what we are delivering. And tuition freeze doesn't really give more resources to the university. And even Oregon Opportunity Grant, you could argue that there is some incremental resources, but there's also incremental delivery of education required. So on a real net basis, if you think about what's really adding resources to the enterprise, Oregon Opportunity Grant, I think, is better than tuition freeze, but still doesn't really let us cover the cost of producing the product that I think you've charged us with producing. And our concern is that in a situation where that output we produce, and I apologize for using private sector terminology here, but the output is very difficult to define, we tend to have the dialogue focused solely on the inputs. And I think we just assume that the output will always be there, and I think that that's really a very dangerous assumption, that we will always be able to deliver quality education no matter how low the resources go. And that is the thing that I think as a board we're most concerned about. We can't always spot quality erosion until we get to the point where we actually have second-rate universities and a second-rate economy in the state of Oregon, and that's really what we're focused on, is trying to make sure that does not happen.
Yes, Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, President Ray and Mr. Blair. I think that Mr. Blair would agree. However, our biggest problem in this state is your company has control of the labor and the cost of that labor, and we don't.
Control of the cost of the labor. Can you clarify your point for me a little?
Sir, I think our problem is we tried to correct the PERS situation. We were not even a third successful. And that's what I hear you.
Oh, yes. You're right. In a private sector environment, we have control, much more control. Absolutely. We all face the rising cost of medical insurance and so on, but you're absolutely right. We have more control over our labor costs than the state does. That's absolutely true.
And that's 85, pardon, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And that's, anywhere from 65 to 85% of our costs. I would also, from all the new board members that I've met, and I've been very impressed, and I think the Chancellor's office and everything's moving in the right direction, is your testimony talked about you're trying to analyze the cost drivers. That's good, but we need you to go with the expertise on that board, the next step, and give us solutions. So, analyzing it is one thing, but if we don't get solutions to get us there, we're not going to So thank you for your service, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
One thing I might put on the record is that the committees that Senator Gordley and I both sit on, with the exception, I hate to cite this with the students in the room, with the exception of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, if we're talking about continuing business as we've done in this last biennium, and if we talk about this new euphemism, essential budget level, I don't think we have a budget that isn't being cut.
Right.
I mean, virtually all the budgets are being reduced from the level that we would think it would be necessary to continue business as usual. So, well, thank you very much for your testimony, and do I have another question?
I just, for Mr. Blair, a little concerned about the response to the good representative regarding control of your private sector control of the labor costs, more control than in the public sector. That's a little bit, it seems to me, of a stretch. If we take industries that require highly skilled, highly trained, professional people, PhD to professional level educations, in the private sector, I think that competition for those individuals might limit the private sector's control of their costs in that. You have to go where the competition is in that case. And in the case of universities, a major part of their, not all, but a significant part of their payroll is highly trained, very skilled, and hopefully very much in demand persons. If they're not in demand, then we are in trouble. So I'm hesitant, not to disagree with my colleague, but I'm hesitant to let that go by without some sort of questioning. It's pretty easy to make, and I don't particularly care, Mr. Chair, whether there's a response to that or not, but I don't see it quite as simple as it maybe is. Just private sector's got an easier time than the public sector has.
Well, let me just address the point I was making here, and maybe I was a little too broad in my response. The representative referred to PERS as an example, and mercifully Nike does not have a defined benefit pension plan. There are many private companies that are suffering with those types of obligations as well. We do have a defined contribution plan, and so we don't have that particular obligation that the state does. We do have a little bit more flexibility, I think, in terms of some of our non-salary benefits. The point you make about competition for quality people, I believe, is absolutely right. Both Nike and the Oregon University system have highly skilled people that are in great demand. One of the interesting difficulties that the Oregon University system has is that not only are faculty members in demand by other universities, but also by private sector companies. And clearly, an environment such as we have here in the state of Oregon, and indeed across a lot of the public universities in the United States, means that those faculty members have lots of opportunities outside of the public sector in private companies, and the pay scales are significantly different. So I absolutely agree with you that on many of the axes that you discussed, private companies and public universities face the same issues. We just don't quite have as many hurdles with respect to things like retirement benefits and medical benefits that the representative had mentioned.
In fact, part of my response to Senator Nelson about we're looking at 4% plus cuts is that we're slipping relative to the competition for faculty compensation, and we know we're going to have to make some decisions, and it needs to be appropriately bounded, but we need to make some decisions within the university about how to redirect our own existing resources to do something about faculty compensation.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative, for necessarily bringing this and adding to the length of time on this, but this happens to be a major concern for me as a member of this committee and as a member of the legislature and as a citizen in the state of Oregon, because it's terribly important that we maintain the very best in our educational system, teaching our children, teaching and laying the foundation for the future then in the state. We can't afford not to, in my estimation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, and then we'll move on.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I guess this goes to Mr. Valera. One of my concerns is that we have this accountability issue, and we seem to be collecting a huge amount of data. And I'm not so sure we're really analyzing it very well. And I don't know if I have the really concern with higher education, but at least with the K-12, they have 61 reports. I don't know that anybody ever uses it. In your experience in the private sector, you guys analyze things. Do you have standards, or is there some way you could give us say, okay, is there a checklist or something to say, okay, these are important things, and if something isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, how do you get rid of it?
Well, first of all, I will tell you, I'm still learning the public side again. I think I studied public sector accounting when I was a CPA student at University of Pennsylvania a long, long time ago, and I had to relearn some of it, and I'm still learning it. So it's different. One of the things that we've tried to do at the Oregon University system is streamline our reporting. Sometimes that actually required us to go a little deeper than what we had been. For example, we had been receiving at the board level what I would consider to be consistent with trying to manage a company using the annual report. You don't really have good data to do it at that level. So we actually needed some information at the institution level. But what we've tried to do is keep it very focused on what's important. And we've worked with the staff at the Chancellor's Office that I think has done a terrific job with the resources they've had available to help us build some of these streamlined management reports. I don't think we're all the way there yet, but my goal would be that if we can't get it to significantly fewer than 60 pages, no one will read it or be able to process it. And so what we'd look to for guidance is the expertise in the Chancellor's Office, as well as a number of professional organizations that assist in the finance and administration of university systems. And so this is an area that's been studied. There are lots of metrics out there, and we're trying to get it down to a manageable level, because we struggle with the same thing at the board level. We need to see those things that give us confidence that the state's money is being spent appropriately and that we're as efficient as we can be. But if we get buried in 60 pages of documentation, we won't be very effective.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Pernsteiner, where do you want to go from here?
Yes.
Okay. But we're only going to here today. Please proceed, and before you... Well, wait a second. We're going to wait. You go ahead and proceed. Somebody just left that I'm supposed to recognize them for their birthday. So, but you...
Well, it's not me. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman, Assistant Chancellor for Budget and Financial Policy for the Oregon University System. I will be addressing budget drivers in the system and trends over time, and hope to be able to answer some of the questions in more detail that have been raised this morning.
In looking at key budget drivers over the past 10 years, the first key driver is the increasing enrollment demand that we've seen over the past years. The decline in state funding and increases in tuition. And then we also want to address the major cost drivers that we see in the system. First, increasing demand, and in terms of cost drivers, this is probably the key one. As you see from this graph, over 10 years, we've had a 45% growth in the number of residents enrolled in our system, and that's nearly 20,000 students. And we expect over time that will continue. If I can have the next slide. I think in phase one, we described our projections for continued demand. We expect 11,000 more students in the system by 2012. This is based both on student demographics. We have more high school students graduating and also just the increasing need for post-secondary education in Oregon. The next important driver is the decline in state funding for OUS. And this is also a slide that we showed you in phase one. And what you see is in 1999-01, we received $10,015 per student, and that is with state funding at $5,111, student tuition at approximately $4,000. In 2005-06, with the governor's recommended budget, we're at estimating $10,423 per student, but you see the dramatic shift. The increase in tuition and the reduction in state funding to $3,691. This next slide is the same, it's exactly the same as the last slide, but we've adjusted it for inflation. And so you see in 2005-06, the governor's rec budget, the same $10,423. In 1999-01, we've adjusted that to $2,004. And what you see there is a decline in purchasing power, basically, in revenues available per student of 8.9% over that time. Another factor that we look at is how we compare with other states in terms of state funding per student. And this is the latest ranking that's available. It's 2002-03. In that year, Oregon funded $5,631 of the student cost, and we ranked 44th in the nation. The U.S. average is $7,978, and you also see the highest ranking, Wyoming at number one, New Hampshire at 50 at $3,633. At the bottom, you see the Oregon figure for 2004-05 has dropped to $3,620 per student in state funding. We realize that other states are likely to have dropped too. We don't know what our ranking will be, but we think we have slipped from 44th. We expect to be lower than that when these numbers are published. Another factor due to the decrease in state funding and the lack of funding for enrollment growth, we've seen increases in tuition that are well above the rate of inflation. Here, the lower line is the CPI adjusted rate, and so the top line shows that. Rates have increased fairly consistently for the last 14 years above the rate of inflation, and particularly since the recession in the last two biennia have increased fairly dramatically. Next, I wanted to address the issue of cost drivers. And at the board's direction, staff in the chancellor's office worked with the campuses to conduct a cost study. And this is a study that will become an annual part of our reporting to the board. The study was also really initiated at the request of the last legislator. We had lots of legislature. We had lots of questions about what are your costs, and it seems like a simple question, but as you look at the cost factors in higher ed, it is difficult to isolate the instructional cost per student, which is what we did in this study, because there are other expenditures for research, for public service, for all those auxiliary services as well. And so this study focused on what the campuses are spending to educate students. Also, I mentioned that the campuses were very involved in this study and in helping us shape the methodology and the analysis. And also, we received help from the Legislative Fiscal Office and Department of Administrative Services. They looked at our approach and gave us feedback that was very helpful. In the study, we also looked at the variations in costs across campuses and tried to get a good understanding of what factors may cause differences in costs across those campuses. We looked at factors driving cost increases, and again, at the request of the Legislative Fiscal Office, we looked carefully at what are the marginal costs of enrolling additional students in the university system. And we believe this was our first recent attempt to really understand our costs in a very detailed way, and we think there's more work to be done. It's a work in progress, but we were able to address all of these issues in looking at the costs for 2003-04. I probably should also mention that one sense, the costs are really expenses. They're what we spent. They're based on what we spent that year. And they're also, in part, a function of the revenues available. And so we need to recognize that, because we do know that, for example, if we were if our faculty salaries were at the national average, for example, that our total cost per student would be higher. That's just an example. The slide you have in front of you now is the
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Appreciate the material here, and thank you for it. But the one question that I have in relationship to these cost drivers is cost per student. Have you calculated in, or are you figuring in any way, the graduate students, the graduate costs with the undergraduate costs? And might this be, with perhaps one exception there, which is a kind of specialized school in its own way, might this be the reason that some of the reason that the costs at the three or four smaller state universities are significantly less?
Senator Gordley, Representative Jensen, yes, this does include graduate and undergraduate costs. It's an average, and the variation you see across the campuses is due to a number of factors, but the program mix, graduate versus undergraduate or professional schools, is a very influential factor in that. For example, in this slide, you see that OIT is has the highest cost per student, which is no surprise based on their mission, the types of programs that they offer. And Western Oregon University is the lowest, and they concentrate on liberal arts and teacher education programs, which tend to have a lower cost. So that was no surprise to us.
But then in conjunction, if I may follow, Mr. In conjunction with that, do we have some sort, in order to be realistic about looking at numbers, we have to have some offset of, you know, income from those types of programs that offset, in some ways, the costs. Do we have any figures of that type? In other words, there are a lot of grants that go into graduate programs that... are fewer in undergraduate programs, especially in liberal arts programs.
Representative Jensen, the grant funding is not included in here. What would be included, the revenues that would support graduate programs, would be the funding that goes through the resource allocation model, which is weighted more heavily for graduate programs, and also just the graduate tuition, where those rates are significantly higher. Moving on to the major cost drivers that we found in the study, as we just discussed, campus mission and the program mix are very influential factors in the cost per student. So that a university that offers more graduate programs or professional programs, for example, will show a higher cost per student. The upper division, lower division student mix makes a difference. Upper division students, that would be the junior and senior year, is more expensive than lower division. Lower division tends to have larger classes and so a lower cost to educate students at that level. Also, type and mix of faculty. I think we discussed that briefly in phase one. We talked quite a bit about the changes we've seen in the system over time, the drop in the number of full-time faculty, the increase in the use of part-time, temporary, and adjunct faculty, which tends to lower the cost. Campus size and class size also are factors. The larger universities do enjoy some economies of scale that the smaller campuses do not. Over-enrollment and under-enrollment, and we're not really seeing under-enrollment in the system right now because of the demand, but over-enrollment will tend to drive the cost down. And an example of that would be Portland State, which is growing very rapidly, and that tends to drive their costs down as their classes are at capacity. And actually just increases efficiency in that sense. The other issue is aging facilities. With our older buildings and the deferred maintenance, that tends to increase operating costs and influence costs for students.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the university system limit how many online courses you can take or correspondence courses you can take per degree? And is that steadily growing within the university system?
Senator Devlin, Representative Wisnant, I am not sure of that information. We can get that back to you tomorrow.
That would, Mr. Chair, follow up. I think that's a cost. That's a way to hold down cost. Or if you allow more correspondence or more online courses and things like that, plus it helps the students' cost.
That's a good point, and we'll respond to that tomorrow.
Thank you.
Before you proceed, I was late in recognizing someone in the audience. There's someone in the audience, I believe, that her birthday is today. Ms. Murdoch from PSU, and on behalf of the committee, we would like to wish you a happy birthday.
Senator Gordon had a question.
I do. And happy birthday. Using your example of, if you could go back to the previous slide, over-enrollment drives down costs, could you say more about that? I'd really like to understand that hydraulic, how that works. And if the same, does that apply to Western Oregon University as well? You gave the PSU as an example.
Chairman Devlin, Senator Gordley, the issue really is one of capacity, and if a campus is growing, then all of their courses tend to be full, or maybe even a little crowded, and it reduces the cost per student. If enrollment were to drop suddenly, you would have extra space in your classes. You'd have an unexpected drop in class size that you really hadn't planned for. You wouldn't have staffed down to meet the decreasing demand, and so your cost per student, at least temporarily, would be high. What we're seeing in the system that is growing very rapidly is that we have the kind of the opposite problem, where we're trying to keep enough staff to keep class sizes down, and so that makes us operate. It looks, on paper at least, it looks more efficient. It may seem crowded in the classroom, but it does drive the cost per student down.
And is that, if I may continue,
yes,
is that description, is that true for Western Oregon University as well, the same dynamics?
Yes, I believe in 2003-04 they had grown. I think there are other factors, however, that probably drive the cost down at Western, and in part that is mission, that they have fewer graduate programs, more liberal arts programs that are not as expensive to provide.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Please proceed.
The next issue is cost increases, and in this study we also looked at the makeup of our spending. This slide is 2003-04 operating expenses, and we found that salaries comprise 56% of our budget. PERS costs are 9% of the budget, PEB at 8%, other payroll costs, mainly Social Security, at 7%, and then supplies and services are at 20% of our budget. And we then looked at the average annual increase in each segment of our budget, and saw that salaries have increased moderately at less than the CPI over this time on the average. This is a 10-year average from 1994 to 2004. PERS and PEB costs were far exceeded the rate of inflation on an annual basis. That supplies and services were basically right at the CPI. And so when we looked at the average weighted increase, because of the those cost drivers of PERS and healthcare costs, our annual cost increased slightly above the rate of inflation at 3.1%.
Chair Devlin?
Yes.
A couple questions on that, if I might. On your PERS and PEB, is that a percentage increase of the PERS and PEB health benefits, or is that a percentage increase of the total compensation package?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wetzel, the PERS costs are a rate increase. It's the increase in the rate, the average rate increase over time.
That's it. 10% per year increase in the actual rate of not of the whole the package, but just of the PERS itself, or the PEB.
Yes, and in PEB it's a 10.5% increase in the premium average each year over this 10-year period.
And that would be also the same. Okay. And then the average weighted increase, what is that, again, what is that?
Well, if you look at the previous slide, we saw that, for example, salaries comprise 56% of the budget. So we said 56% of the budget increased at the 2.1% rate per year, and we did that with each component. So we weighted according to the proportion of the budget. So overall, with salaries increasing 2.1%, the benefits increasing at a much faster rate, the overall total increase in the budget was 3.1% per year on average.
One question I had, although you pay a composite rate for PERS, do you track how many Tier 1, Tier 2, and under the new system employees you have?
Senator Devlin, yes, we do. And in fact, in the new tier, the third tier in PERS, we are paying a different rate on those employees.
Okay.
The Tier 1 and Tier 2 are the same rate, but it is getting more complicated each year to track the PERS costs.
And can you provide me with what your current data is on that in terms of the makeup of your employees, Tier 1, Tier 2, and the program?
Yes, we can do
program.
That.
Well, I'll hesitate to ask this, but I will ask it. On the PEB health benefits, I have had some people state that since you are part of the state pool, that your costs are higher than they would be given the demographics of your employees. Can you substantiate that?
Senator Devlin, I will have to...
I mean, you have younger employees is what it comes to.
Senator Devlin, we do believe that our costs are lower than the state average because of our demographics. I am not certain if I can get that information from PEB immediately, but we can try to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Another cost driver that I mentioned is just the our aging buildings, the deferred maintenance. Means that it does affect our operating costs, and we know that newer buildings well-maintained buildings would cost us less to operate. So that's just another factor that influences our costs. Moving on then, the next section is to talk about major changes in the OUS over the last several years, and looking at budget reductions, cost containment efforts, improvements in program delivery, and then I'll briefly mention the Chancellor's Office reorganization, which President Lorenzen talked about yesterday. This slide is one that we discussed briefly also in Phase 1, but it just shows the drop in state general fund support from the original 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget. $830.3 million were allocated to the system. The governor's recommended budget at $685 million, a drop in that time of 17%. The next slide is just a comparison of the Senate co-chair's budget with the governor's recommended budget. What you see total state general funds will increase in that budget by $23 million approximately. The other funds limited is mostly the tuition and fees funding, which will be reduced with the proposed tuition freeze by $33.5 million. And so the total available revenue for the system to spend would decrease by $10 million. The next slide is just the House co-chair's budget. Some of the changes are slightly different in this budget, but the bottom line is basically the same, with total state general fund increasing by nearly $24 million, the reduction from the proposed tuition freeze, and a net change from the governor's recommended budget of $9.6 million. I wanted to talk a little bit about the efficiencies that have been implemented over a number of years in the university system. All of these were implemented by the legislature in the past several years. First, Senate Bill 271 in 1995, and that transferred responsibility and accountability to the State Board of Higher Education for a number of business matters, including personnel issues, purchasing, contracting, and other business matters. And in 1999, a study was conducted to try to determine to evaluate the efficiencies and to determine the savings. And at that point, it was determined that there was an annual savings of $7 million due to those changes. And also in 1995, the OHSU reorganization, health sciences was a part of the university system, split off and became a public corporation affiliated with the university system with its own board of directors. Senate Bill 437 in the 2003 legislative session extended some of the administrative responsibility and flexibility that had been initiated in 1995, mainly dealing with purchasing and contracting. Other efficiencies, just very briefly, the reorganization in this biennium of the Chancellor's Office by the Board of Higher Education, with the new focus on policy and accountability, and transfer of support functions to the campuses. The next slide shows just a recap of the budget changes in the Chancellor's Office over the last two biennia, beginning with a budget of $31.7 million originally in 2001-03, reductions of budget cuts of $5.6 million in the biennium, reorganization savings that our board president spoke to you about yesterday of $6 million, budgets and functions shifted out to the campuses, $6.7 million, and with the proposed reduction in the co-chair's budget, a final budget for 05-07 proposed at $12.7 million. You also heard in the fund balance discussion that there were some funds shifted to campuses from the Chancellor's Office fund balance, and so far this biennium that is $4.9 million that went to mitigate tuition increases and provide other support to campuses. And with that concludes this presentation, and I'd be open to any questions that you might have.
Any questions?
Going back to slide 21, maybe this is for Mr. Bender. Slide 21, State General Fund, you have $685 million, but some of the other documents I've seen actually that the governor's recommended budget was $750 million. Where is that difference of money?
The other documents showing $750 million.
Yeah, this is
OHSU's budget is actually included, I believe, within
in higher education.
In higher education.
That is okay.
Okay.
I'm just checking. Okay, and then slide nine. So that's the slide nine. Just for my clarification, I think you were talking about education and general program funds, the tuition and loss. And it goes back to my earlier question about the $14.8 million. Basically, that's tuition we're doing is shifting the $14.8 million. We're taking out general fund, and we're saying you guys pick it up in tuition. Is that am I going in the right direction there?
Senator Nelson. That's basically it. When we look at the change from the 2003-05 budget and the funding that we have today, when we combine general fund and tuition, and then we look at our cost increases to carry on business as usual with the same number of students for next year, we're showing that we're slightly the governor's rec budget does not quite cover those costs. We're 1 to 2% short, we believe. In addition, we're expecting 3,600 additional students next biennium, and we're receiving no general funds for those students. And that puts us short an additional about $15 million.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, I want to go back to the cost increases slide. The difference between the average weighted increase you have at 3.1% and the CPI at 2.4% is about 30%. And then if you look at supplies and services, which is 2.4, and Portland CPI, which is 2.4, which is the same, the entire disparity comes from employee compensation, which is, you know, by my figure shows up to be about 37.5% faster than the CPI. We have heard testimony that the faculty is being paid a great deal less, or substantially less, than their peers in other universities. There's a disparity there. That is that because the non-faculty employees of the Oregon University system are being paid at a greatly higher level than their peers? I mean, there's a disparity there. It doesn't make sense.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whipset, we believe that the non-faculty employees are paid closer to market rates than the faculty are. We know that our faculty are, when we look at total compensation, we rank in the lowest 30th percentile in terms of our three large universities as compared to other universities around the country. And I think the answer is that retirement and health benefit costs have grown rapidly across the country. This just isn't in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Our faculty salaries have been very low for a long time, really since the changes brought on by Measure 5 in the early 90s.
Chair Devlin, yes. I appreciate that. But by my figures, if they're accurate, the rate of increase in employee compensation has been 37.5% above CPI for 10 consecutive years. Do you see where there's a disparity I'm trying to get my hands on is if I understand that the faculty is being paid less than their peers, but where is that employee compensation going that has exceeded CPI by 375% in 10 years total?
Senator Whipset, the main drivers are the health care costs and the PERS benefits. And from an employee point of view, they don't see an increase in benefits. They've retained benefits, but it's just the cost drivers that are, it's a national issue, and that's why I believe we're not gaining ground as compared, even with these large cost increases over time, we're not gaining ground against other faculties in other states.
Chair, for the follow-up, then apparently the public employee sector compensation is going up much more rapidly than the private sector compensation package would, because the CPI is based on the blend of both, isn't it?
Senator Whitson, I think one issue in education is that we are heavily labor intensive, and so, you know, 80% of our budget goes to salaries and benefits. So that has a larger impact on our budget than it would on many private sector businesses.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I'm on slide 25, efficiencies. And I'd like to have you help me understand that a little more. We start out with an annual or a biannual budget there of 31.7 for the chancellor's office. That's what we're dealing with here,
yes.
Right? Now, the reductions in 03-05 are not necessarily be referred to as efficiencies, are they? Other than the fact that the legislature may have thought they were efficiencies for it.
Representative Jensen, those were simply, they were simply budget cuts.
Yes, okay.
Based on lack of revenue.
So then we're down to a figure of 26.1 as far as, and then we do reorganizational savings.
Yes.
And this is $6 million. And so we're down to a budget of 20.1 or something of that nature. Then we do this budget shift to campuses, and this is really no savings to anybody, is it? I mean, as far as we are concerned here when we're writing checks on this, we just write it to different people.
Representative Jensen, yes, that's correct. An example would be our technology services function, which was handled by the chancellor's office, was shifted to Oregon State University. We saved about $1 million by doing that, but we shifted our budget out there and those functions and those employees. And you'll pay for those employees at OSU now instead of in the chancellor's office.
So the efficiencies that we have really are still back to $6 million.
Yes.
And then we get a governor's budget, and then we get the co-chair's budget, and we lose another $700,000. And this is just a cut, then.
That's correct.
For which we will contend that it's an efficiency sort of thing.
And I think you heard from President Lorenzen yesterday that the State Board is very concerned about the magnitude of the cuts in the governor's budget and in the co-chair's budget, because the board reduced found efficiencies of $6 million, but they intended to take about at least half of that money and reinvest it in supporting their initiatives and strengthening certain functions in the chancellor's office that don't exist there now.
Follow, Mr. Chair. Am I to assume that, let's say, $3 million, that $3 million was given to the governor when he was drawing his budget up as part of that essential budget level at $3 million policy package?
Of the $6 million, the governor cut $4.7 million, and the co-chairs cut an additional $0.7
million. Oh, so there's 4.7 here. All right. Now I've got the numbers lined up.
Mr. McGee wanted to respond to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, as we mentioned yesterday, the governor has made a recommendation now that you restore $2.8 million of the amount that he cut out of his budget.
Yeah, I was trying to get back to that 4.7. I wasn't seeing where I was.
I still might reiterate the question from yesterday. It might be helpful if someone would give us a document telling us what all of the governor's adjustments are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions at this time? Thank you very much. Mr. Van Fleet and the Chancellor. Mr. Van Fleet, because we do have a few people with that this is their we have two people that this is their first session. Could you recall your legislative background here? Just so that...
I couldn't do that, Mr. Chair, at the end when I had all of these people step back as not to be associated with me on what I was going to say. Thank you. I'm Tony Van Vliet. I reside at 1530 Northwest 13th in Corvallis, and I'm currently on the Board of Higher Education and Chairman of the Oregon Public Broadcasting System. I sat in that chair for 17 years where you are. I was co-chair of Ways and Means in 1991 that had the great pleasure of putting Ballot Measure 5 into existence. And during that 17 years, most of that time was spent on the two largest budget committees, Human Resources and Education. I alternated between morning and afternoon for those 17 years, or 10 sessions, or I should say 8 sessions of the legislature. So I feel your pain. Other than that, I will reserve the rest of my questions or my talk to you a little bit about history until the very end, and I'll turn it over to the Chancellor to jump into his presentation, and I'll wrap it up with what I was supposed to carry today, and then also a little history going back to 1980.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, George Pernsteiner, Acting Chancellor, Oregon University System. One of the joys of Phase 2 of Ways and Means is that we are told which topics we should probably cover. And so my signal privilege today is to cover some of the required topics that come up in Phase 2. And I'll try to do that as briefly as possible and as clearly as I can so that we can move on to the discussion that Director Van Vliet mentioned. The topics are the resource allocation model, tuition, financial aid, and fee remissions. Back in 1998, the Oregon University system had a budget allocation system. In 1998, that system included 228 factors. And there was one, and if we were fortunate, perhaps two people in the world who understood the interplay of the 228 factors. At that time, both the legislature and the business community said...
I have to know. That sounds like a DHS budget, but please...
Mr. Chair, I would not pretend to understand a DHS budget, nor was I one of the two people who understood the 228 factors. But at that time, we had discussions both with the business community and with members of both chambers in this body and both parties in this body to try to come up with something that was clearer, more understandable, and could be used to explain how it was that we budgeted. And the result was the resource allocation model, which was adopted by the Board of Higher Education in 1998 and funded by this body in 1999. It was a model that was based on looking at what other universities did, how much other universities paid for things, and then modeling what it would cost to do that in Oregon. And it had two basic components to it. In terms of the state support was to pay for resident students and for targeted programs. And the students were divided into several categories. The lower division, freshman, sophomore, upper division, junior, senior, master's, doctorate, and professional. And we had a very few professional schools. Vet med, law are the two that immediately come to mind. We then looked at, around the country, what did it cost other universities to provide education for freshmen, sophomores, juniors and seniors, master's, doctorate, and professional. And we found that costs fell into three broad categories. There were lower cost disciplines, sociology, English. There were medium cost disciplines, education as an example. There were higher cost disciplines, engineering, sciences as examples. And we then modeled a resource system so that if a student were to enroll at a university and take credits in engineering, say, if all they took were engineering credits, there would be dollars then that would flow to that university based on what that student chose to take and what the university then was able to teach. That was what we call the cell funding. And it was basically driven by the cost of the disciplines, the discipline mix at the different campuses, and the level of the student, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, master's, doctorate, or professional. We then had another component, and two-thirds roughly of the fund of the state funding went to fund students. So you may recall the mantra from the 99 session of dollars following students. About two-thirds of the monies that the state appropriated went to fund students under that matrix. The other third went in what we call targeted programs. And when you did your prioritization a few weeks ago at the end of phase one, you actually went into each of those targeted programs because they are line items in our budget. Line items such as research, line items such as public service, line items such as each of the statewide public services. All of those were the targeted programs that were part of the resource allocation model. So that is the resource allocation model in a nutshell. It's driven two-thirds of it roughly by student enrollment. Roughly a third of it was driven by those targeted programs. What happened when the budget reductions occurred in the 2003-2005 interim is that the Board of Higher Education recognized that when monies fell as rapidly as they fell, as appropriations were reduced as rapidly as they were, that the universities could not absorb those reductions as rapidly as they were occurring where they happened. Now, let me make that a little clearer, because even I didn't understand what I just said. We discovered that the regional campuses, the smaller campuses, could not cut their budgets fast enough in order and still keep open. And so what the board did is to freeze the enrollment portion of the RAM funding at the 2002-03 enrollment levels, so that the growth that has occurred in 2003-04 and in 2004-05 did not run through the RAM model. We just froze it at 2002-03 in order to help the regional campuses not have to reduce costs as fast as they otherwise would have to, because they just could not flat do it fast enough. And so the resource allocation model is the model that the board uses. It's that portion of it has been in suspension now for the last couple of years. As was discussed yesterday, we will be looking at the regional campuses during the 2005-07 biennium, and as well as the whole state system in terms of its financial sustainability. And that was one of the things I think that some of the members mentioned yesterday. So that basically is the resource allocation model. We have been using it. We suspended a portion of it because of the budget reductions. But it is still the method by which we calibrate where we think we are, both vis-a-vis the rest of the country and vis-a-vis each of the campuses compared to one another. Another major budgetary issue, and it's one you've dealt with a lot in this subcommittee, is tuition. The budget as proposed in the governor's recommended budget presumes about a 7% increase in resident undergraduate tuition in 2005-06, and another 5% in 2006-07. What you have in front of you here is what we currently charge in the way of tuition. And the resident tuition is about $4,000 in 2004-05 on average. And by the time you put in then the additional fees, some of which are legislated, like the building fee, some of which are voted in by the students, basically like the incidental fees, and some of which are put in by the board, like resource or the technology fee, you get to a level of about $5,000 on average across the seven campuses. But that actually hides a difference. because the lowest of the campuses is Western at about $4,332 this year, and the highest, the University of Oregon, is about $5,670. So you can see that there's a range within the campuses, but the average is right around $5,000. So as you move forward into the next biennium, the governor's recommended budget presumes then an increase that is no greater than 7% on average in the first year and 5% on average in the second year against roughly that $5,000 number.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Chancellor? Mr. Chancellor, is the university system still charging that energy fee that they charged for a while? When energy costs went up?
Do we? Eastern and U of O do. The others do not.
They still do? Okay. And I'm surprised that none of the universities have charged a fee for fuel because the price of gasoline has gone up. But I'd like some explanation as to why those two schools are still charging an energy fee.
We'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Another question, actually. On the resident tuition, that being the average, if we were talking about a 7 and 5, we'd be talking roughly about around a $500 increase over the biennium. Would that be a little bit less than $500?
Yeah, right around 5, yes. Yeah. About 7% of $38.58 and then 5% of the DUNC. Yeah.
Would we anticipate that many of those other fees would be increasing substantially in that period of time?
Mr. Chair, some of them are suggested for increase, which is why the amount that the co-chairs have used for the tuition freeze is 33.5 as opposed to 32 million. I'm sorry. Some of them, the building fee is legislatively set, so that won't change. And the incidental fees are often voted in by the student governments, and they vary from campus to campus. It's the technology fees that I think mostly are embedded in what the co-chairs have figured out, unless I'm wrong.
And the health fee?
I think Steve has a...
The health fee is negotiated, right,
Mr. Chair, the health fee varies from campus to campus, in part depending upon the health programs that are offered there and how much of it is done in health centers versus how much is done by insurance, and that... And the insurance portion is negotiated with carriers at those campuses.
Okay. I had Senator Nelson and I believe Representative March and then Representative Jensen. Or Representative Senator Nelson and Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Just a clarification there. 15 credit hours, average annual tuition. Are you talking about 45 credit hours total year? You'd be paying $15,000 or is this just taking 15 credit hours for the three quarters?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, this is the annual cost, and it's 45 credit hours.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker brought up the issue of energy, which leads me to a question. Have all of the campuses, all of the facilities that you have, undergone an energy audit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, many of them have, not all of them, but many of them have. We have done energy audits on a fairly aggressive basis starting in around 1990, and we do them with some frequency, particularly in education and general buildings, but I can't say that all of them are done. But a lot of them have been, some of them have been done two and three times. We went through and did a major relamping project in the early 90s at Portland State, for example. We've gone through and changed out ballasts for the lighting in some of the campuses in an attempt to reduce energy costs. We've changed, one of the biggest things we've done is to go in and put in new control systems at both Western and PSU that have reduced costs as well. And that's based on a building by building audit that we've done on those campuses of those things. So I'm aware of at least those two campuses.
If I could follow, Mr. Chair, with just a how many of the campuses have how many, if any, have extended that type of audit to water?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I don't know. We can check that. That's a good point.
Coming from another committee that I'm serving on, water conservation is a heartburn issue for me. Not that the other conservations are not, but Somewhere, Mr. Chair, if we could, I'd like to have kind of a...
We haven't struck thermal on the OSU campus yet.
You haven't?
No. But you've been... We're running ours on baling wire and chewing gum and hot air.
Oh, okay. I thought all of that construction out there kind of on the southwest part of the thing was okay.
Mr. Chancellor, time check now. Mr. Van Fleet, I believe in your schedule, has about 10 minutes in your schedule.
Well, I can roll very fast, Mr. Chair, and then I think I can still get to what I want to talk about. My assignment today was basically to talk about faculty salaries, and I think a lot of you have already seen that it's not an unusual story. After my 35 years on the faculty at Oregon State, to have lost a lot of colleagues, basically who left the campus basically for better jobs because our faculty salary structure was such that we're probably at least $10,000 to $15,000 off the national average in many of the particular ranks. The governor in his budget had a $1 million investment through the elimination of the salary freeze, which would be a very definite benefit for us to be able to assist some of holding in some of our better professors who might be wanting to leave the campus. My other one topic to talk about is the integrated data system, and I know a lot of you have already had visits to your office about that because it is a same thing that you have faced in human resources and a lot of other agencies, and that is how to get a bunch of data all working together. And we have tried to do that through the PASS system and through some of the Department of Education system in gathering data so we know what students are getting in a particular high school level, having that data be readily available at the university and community college level, and with the new transfer module that has just been agreed upon between community colleges and higher ed, to be able to actually have students move much more seamlessly through the process. And the last piece, of course, is the possible further use of the Atlas project, which will allow students then to do some of their own self-counseling. So that is a good investment, and we heartily support that. The last item that the board, of course, is interested in is the long piece of COPs, which you're faced with every session in those certificates of participation, and that is to try to bring a lot of our data processing systems up to level and get them so that they're on in step into the 21st century. That list has been whittled down by the campuses themselves and by the state board. And so what you have before you is a whittled down list of very essential items of approximately $20 million in integrated data system improvements as well as that come in with the COPs. Now, that is sums up my presentation on that, and I will, before I take off my hat as a state board member, I will put on my hat as a former faculty member very quickly for you, and then I'll put my hat on as a legislator. My hat on as a faculty member, a lot of my colleagues never knew that I was the first Extension Forest Products Extension person in the state of Oregon in 1963 to 1970. If I had to put venture capital in economic development, I would put it in the statewides, and I'll tell you, you get more bang for the buck out of there than you've seen out of any other place in economic development. All you have to do is turn to Eastern Oregon and see the result of the Stevens brand of wheat. All you have to do is look in the forest products industry and see the particle board development and flake board development. Our job in extension was to take the results of the laboratory research, take it out to the field, have it be put into use, and bring problems back that they wanted solved. It works beautifully for both agriculture and forestry, and it works in a lot of other segments of the university. All right, I'll take off my university hat. You people can stand back. You no longer know me. I am going to put on my former legislative hat, and let me just talk to you about where we are in this whole situation and what you're facing right now, because I do sympathize with you. We have hit since 1979, we've had two major recessions, 1980 to 1985, and 1990 on, we have not left that one. And in that time, we've also had the public pass on to you and us several initiatives that have driven us right into the ground. Ballot Measure 5, Ballot Measure 11, and 4750. Okay? You and I all know that. You've had 14 regular sessions since that particular time, and 19 special sessions. I've been in 10 of those and 11 special sessions, all of them about budgets. Now, logically, step back and just think now, over 14 sessions, 1980, that's 25 years. Don't you think that we've whittled all the fat out of state government and all the inefficiencies? Now, if you haven't, of course you can find little pockets here and there. That's your job. But you can't convince me and a lot of people in the school districts in Corvallis and a lot of people around the rest of the state that in that 25 years we have not thrown enough people overboard out of the lifeboats that this government is operating very thinly. If you don't believe that, turn to the Governing magazine and see how Oregon is rated. Oregon is currently listed as the two worst states in the nation. California and Oregon, the two states in red, as the worst states around for financial fiscal responsibility. That means we haven't done our job. In 1980, we had a $600 million shortfall and a $2.8 billion budget with a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature. We could find $300 million, robbing every tin can that was available. Some of it came back to haunt us. And a governor who refused to tear the fabric of the state apart and said, we'll go for a surtax. And did. We keep harping on the fact that we're tied to CPIs. The CPIs in higher education have no bearing whatsoever. There is no relationship between grocery stores and housing as it refers to the CPIs that happen on the campus. Senator Winsor was and I were at the opening of the new vet school, walked through the in there through the equipment. That equipment doesn't follow a CPI factor. In fact, I often have said one of the things we ought to do in the legislature is develop a governmental group of CPIs that really reflect the government and have no relationship to the CPI that we're told about. It makes a good argument for running for election, but not a very good one for running a state system. In 1991, when we put this particular budget to bed and had to find $773 million to fund schools because of ballot measure 5. This is what we did to higher education. We appropriated $706 million. Does that figure seem similar? Here we are 15 years later with the same budget. And we put more burden on the students. We increased tuition 6.7%. We approved an enrollment of 4,000 more students. And we eliminated 68 academic programs we threw out of the lifeboat. That's what we did in 91. Not to mention leaving $90 million on the table for human resources and a whole bunch of boards and commissions, which everybody is always eager to throw out of the lifeboat, even if they're only a few million dollars. And we did that. And you have done it too. So now you sit here and we still grapple with the fact of arguing about whether the co-chair's budget is so many million this way or so many in the Senate is so many million this way. And in that 25 years, we have refused only two times did the legislature address the issue, the real issue of the problem. Once when we raised a surtax, which was temporary, and second, when we went for a sales tax in 83. The rest of that time, everybody's been off the radar screen. And because we're always anxious to get out of here, let me tell you that the public is not going to give us any brownie points as legislators for getting out of here without addressing the real problem. Now, Steve, I don't know if Steve has showed you this, but each year I have the Legislative Fiscal Office run these charts out. Because when I go around and give talks, it's a delight to listen to people about cutting budgets. And, of course, the first one they bring out is this one. Where are all those dollars going? That budget is going straight up. Some of you have seen this before. Then I bring out the one adjusted for CPI and for population growth. And what people don't recognize is between the period of 1991 or 75 and now, we've gone from 2.4 million people in the state of Oregon to 3.4. And when you adjust that, what is the real, in $79, what is your budget today? $3 billion. And most of that has been taken up by education because of ballot measure 5 and has been taken up by public safety by building a lot of prisons at a tune of about $35,000 an inmate. And what we have done is we've pulled away using fees. We've increased fees. We've increased tuition. We have eliminated a lot of transfer fees from city and county government that we were proud to help out city and county government with transfer fees to help them out in mental health, health services, police. Those are no longer and being greatly diminished. So what I leave you with is here we are, State Board of Higher Education, coming with hat in hand, hoping that we can struggle getting a few more dollars into statewide, hoping that we can get at least a break on the rest of the budget, and we still are avoiding the problem. Sorry to take your time and the use of the hall, but...
Well, thank you very much for the presentation.
Okay.
Unfortunately, due to the time that we have now, we'll probably have to, we'll come back tomorrow morning and you will, and we will consult Mr. Bender and the Chancellor and see how we can complete everything tomorrow. For the sake of the committee, we are getting a tentative word that we will be allowed to meet next week. If we can get the okay to pass out a few small other funds budgets next week, I may do something. My alternative is actually is to call an extra meeting. But rather than call an extra meeting, I might ask that members, rather than starting at 8:30 on Wednesday and Thursday, can start at 8 a.m.
Next week?
Next week.
Is that for certain? Or
not for certain. I'll let you know on Monday.
I have appointments a couple weeks out.
Okay.
That start at 7:45 in the morning.
My other alternative is to find another time that everybody could meet.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would like to address former Representative Van Vliet before we all get away. I want to thank you for your words. I call it a reality check. Thank you. I know that you are familiar with Article 9 of the Constitution, the chapter on finance, Sections 2 and 6. Your comments reflect that you are aware of what our legislative responsibility and mandate include. I want to say to you that when I came into this legislature in the early 90s, I had the opportunity to serve with you, sir, and I want you to know that I watched you. And I listened to you. You were my role model for how to work in a bipartisan, fashion. So again, I want to thank you, and I want you to know that your words need to be shared more widely than this panel today, Mr. Chair. Let's be in touch with OPAN, the Oregon Public Access Network, and make sure that this committee hearing gets on to OPAN and that it gets repeated. The message that Mr. Van Vliet has brought forward is one that needs to be heard and appreciated not only by every single legislator in this building, but by all Oregonians, many of whom do not realize that we're resting on mediocrity. We are heading down, and it is we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity, and Mr. Van Vliet has painted it for us, painted what that opportunity is, to turn things around. But again, I just want to acknowledge that your words have been heard and felt, and they are deeply appreciated.
Thank you, Senator Gordy, and thanks to Nancy for relinquishing her time today. I'm going to make sure she comes back tomorrow morning to finish off.
Representative Jensen, and then we'll have to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate very much former representative and now State Board Higher Education comment in relationship to this. However, if I could, I think I would suggest that the problem in Oregon since the time you're talking about to the date that we're talking about today is maybe a slightly bit more complex than the initial portrayal. And I think Senator Nelson has frequently in front of this committee advised many people about one area of the problems, and that has been the very rapid decline in the natural resource industries in the state of Oregon. Industries which paid good money for their employees, and employees which then paid good money for our only taxing structure that we basically have in this state. And I think if we don't address the public policy of where and how we're going to have jobs, employment, industry in the state, regardless of what we might do in terms of a method of taxation or the amount of taxation, we're going to continue to have problems like we're sitting here facing today. And just as all of the people, I think, on the committee know, and probably many of you know, I did try very hard to work in the past couple of sessions toward a restructuring of the Oregon tax system.
No, you didn't.
I worked very hard for, you know, some other issues which got shot down pretty significantly by the citizens of the state, but all of these efforts would have been much easier had we been using all of the resources, and I don't mean just natural resources, but all of the resources of the state toward the goal of providing more jobs and more good living wage jobs, which we have somehow or another failed to do. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for your
thank you, Representative.
With that, I will close the hearings on SB 5513, 5514. Close this hearing and see you all tomorrow morning.
Thank you.